Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. You often speak about the tools that we each have in our toolbox. On your spiritual journey, which of the tools in your toolbox have you found the most helpful and why? One of the concepts that I talk about a lot is how we move through the world with our own toolbox. And that toolbox is how we respond to the world. So let's say that you get yourself into a situation where compassion is required, or resilience is required, or patience is required, or understanding is required. Well, if in your personal toolbox, you don't have patience, you don't have understanding, you don't have compassion, then you're not going to be able to respond to that situation with it. Because usually what happens in our world is people hurt us. Not intentionally, not meaning to hurt us. But they do it because they're not able to respond to that situation skillfully. So let's say that I'm walking through a situation and I see this nail sticking out of the wall. Well, what am I going to do? I'm going to pull a hammer out and hammer it. Or I'm going to call someone and say, get a hammer and hammer that nail back in. But if I open up the toolbox and there is no hammer, and all I've got in my toolbox is a paintbrush or a fork, well, I'm not going to be able to do proper justice to that nail. I'm going to whack it with a paintbrush. I'm going to whack it with a fork. Now, if the nail were a living being, if the nail were one of us, it would feel like, who the hell are you? What are you doing? Don't you understand I'm a nail? What I need is a hammer. Why are you whacking me? Without understanding that, yeah, we'd love to hammer the nail back in, we just don't have a hammer. And this is a metaphor that I use, and it's the foundation for the question of when people hurt us in life. There's so many times in our life when what we need from someone is understanding, or we need patience, or we need compassion. But the people in our lives respond with impatience, or they respond with anger, or they respond without understanding. And then we get hurt. But we blame them for that, without understanding that they didn't wake up in the morning planning to hurt us. They didn't wake up in the morning planning to make a mess of that situation. They're just moving through the world with a toolbox. And when the situation required love or generosity or openness or understanding, they opened up their toolbox and they didn't have any. What they had was fear, anger, loneliness, unfulfilled expectation, grudges. And so that's all they have to respond to the world with. And our toolbox gets created throughout our lives. It begins in our childhood. Our parents give us the first tools. So if we're raised with patience, we're raised with understanding, we're raised with generosity, we develop tools of patience and generosity. But if we're raised with impatience, we're raised in the every man for himself model of life, we're raised with abuse, then we don't end up with tools of love and generosity in our toolbox, and we don't have them then to respond to others with. So that's the foundation of this question, which was, on your spiritual journey, which of the tools in your toolbox have you found most helpful and why? On a personal level for me, I think the tool that was most beneficial for me and has been for most of my life has been the knowledge, the deep, deep, deep awareness that I deserve, I'm entitled to. Last night we spoke about privilege, how life is a privilege. I was really raised with the belief, the knowledge, that I was entitled to a happy life, a good life, good things in life. It's the way my parents raised me. You can do anything, be anyone, have anything, achieve anything. I was raised to believe the world is good. When I was very, very young, my mom used to take me to this place near our house that had this huge slide. Enormous, enormous slide, but she, of course, was too scared to go down it with me. And so she'd grab any random guy going up the stairs, and she'd say, "Would you take my daughter down the slide?" I was maybe 3, 4, 5 at the time. Now, today, people would look at you like you're crazy. People would, you know, try to get you arrested for child endangerment, to just hand off your toddler girl into the hands of some unknown male stranger. But my mom had this, still has this very deep, deep belief in the goodness of people. And so it never occurred to her that anything would happen to me. She used to teach me, strangers are just friends we haven't met yet. That was the motto that I was raised with. And so that combined a faith in people around, in the goodness of people, and faith in the universe, that the universe was good, that you were entitled to good things, that there always would be enough. I was not raised with fear. I was raised with a sense of plenty. And what that did for me in my life was enabled me on my spiritual journey, because that's what the question asks, is on your journey, which of the tools? Well, if I didn't have faith in the universe, if I didn't have faith in the goodness of the universe, the rightness of the universe, I think it would have been very difficult at 25 to leave the world that I came from, to leave a path that I knew was going to take me into financial success, career success, for a spiritual life. To walk out of a world in which everything is set for you on a physical, tangible level, and to walk into a place where you don't speak the language, you don't know anybody, you don't know anything about the culture, you have no idea what tomorrow is going to bring, you have no idea how long they're going to let you stay here. When I first moved here, Parmarth had a 15-day maximum policy. Right? I mean, we still do on paper. You've 15-day maximum. You've actually still got to get special permission. It's granted if you're a sincere sadhak, but you've got to get special permission to stay more than 15 days. So if I had been raised with fear, what's going to happen to me? Where's my next meal going to come from? Who's going to put the roof over my head? What's going to happen? It would have been very difficult to take that step in faith with what I had experienced and to have faith in the people, to have faith in the world, to have all of that faith. So I think that was probably the most beneficial tool. The other one, though, that I would mention is a deep commitment to truth. In my home growing up, telling a lie was the absolute worst sin you could commit. You could have done something horrible, but if you admitted it, the punishment would be almost nothing. And on the flip side, you could have done almost nothing, but if you lied about it, there was hell to pay in my house. You didn't lie. And you didn't lie even about little things. There was no such thing as a white lie in my house. And so I was really raised with this truth at all costs belief. I remember actually my last year in high school, I was 17. And I had fallen in love. First love. To me, we were soulmates, and we were going to be together forever. It was just, I mean, you know what first love is like when you're a teenager. But he was a year older than I was. And he was going off to college the next year. And I remember having dinner with my dad, and he said to me, So Eric's going off to college next year. What are the two of you going to do? And I said, oh, well, you know, we're going to stay together, of course, because we're soulmates. I mean, of course, we have to be together. We're soulmates. I said, but we're going to have an open relationship. And my dad, now I have to back up for a moment. My dad is a divorce attorney. A very successful divorce attorney. The man spends all day long, morning till evening, divorcing people. And he's done that for decades and decades and decades. And so all he hears all day long are the fights of husbands and wives who are getting divorced. Okay, so he's now sitting at the table with his 17-year-old daughter who's telling him that we're going to stay together because we're soulmates, but we're going to have an open relationship. And my dad says to me, what does that mean? And I said, well, Dad, you know, in that voice, like, you know, what century were you born in? I said, it means we will be free to date other people because he's going to be far away. We'll be free to date other people, but we will be totally honest about it. We're going to tell each other everything. And we're going to stay together, of course, because we are soulmates. So my dad, in really what now, 30 years later, I still think he deserves an award for how to parent a teenager, says to me, he says, so let me get this straight. He says, you're going to date other people, tell each other about it, and then stay together. And I said, well, yes, of course. And he says, not, what are you, an idiot? Not, I've spent my life getting couples divorced. This is the stuff divorces are made of. He looks at me and he says, well, that sounds very interesting. I look forward to hearing how that works out for you. And I share that story, not just to highlight how wonderful my dad was, but because this is the commitment to truth that I was raised with, of truth will supersede everything. Yes, we have to date other people because we are far away. Yes, we will stay together because we are soulmates. And of course, we will tell each other about it because I could not imagine in my life there being any reason, any acceptable situation in which the truth would not be the right thing to do. As ridiculous as it sounds in retrospect, the idea of we're going to date other people and then report to each other about it. But in my idealistic truth at all costs youth, the truth had to lead only to goodness. You could not have a relationship with anyone that wasn't rooted in 100% truth. I knew it would hurt. I wasn't stupid. I knew it wasn't going to be fun to hear. But the truth conquers all. Truth was God. So truth had to be told. And I would say that that's the second and very, very powerful tool that I was given, because then, again, when I had this experience on the banks of Ganga, when I knew that this was where I was meant to be, there was no way I could not live it. People say to me, God, it's amazing that you decided to stay. It's amazing that you left that world. It's amazing that you came here. But for me, there actually was no option. I could not deny the truth that I had seen. I could not deny what I had experienced. It didn't come in the package that I thought my life's happiness was going to come in. I mean, I was on a path. I was getting a PhD in psychology. I was going to live a normal life. House, a white picket fence, kids, career, vacations at resorts. I mean, all the things that you think a good life is made of. I was not expecting that the package of the happiness of my life was going to come in renunciation, in celibacy, in spirituality, in an ashram in India. But when it happened, when I had that awareness, when I had that opening, because truth was the biggest tool in my toolbox, it was the only thing, every time I opened my toolbox, what stared me in the face was truth. There was no way I could deny that I'd had that experience. There was no way I could turn my back on it and say, I didn't see that. And so that commitment to truth led me here. And it's been interesting, actually, because in India, what I've realized is a different definition of truth. And a definition that takes aspects other than just truth into consideration. So for example, one of the things that comes up so frequently for people here is, well, that's not true, or this isn't true, and how easily people in this country will tell you things that they think you want to hear. They think it's nicer to tell you something that makes you happy in the moment than that what may necessarily be the truth. And then I learned that in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna gives a beautiful teaching on tapas of speech, the right speech, spiritual speech, dharmic speech. And what he tells us is it actually must fulfill three criteria. It must be true. He's not condoning white lies. It must be true. But it must also be kind and beneficial. And what that means is that there are times when silence is the highest virtue. Where in my truth at all costs It may hurt, but it's the truth, so you need to hear it, so I need to speak it. Believe that that was a little bit short-sighted. That there's a package that truth comes in order for it to be dharmic speech. And just being true isn't enough. We must always ask ourselves, is it also kind? Is it also beneficial? And of course, he doesn't say 2 out of 3 is enough. This is 100% or nothing rule. So it's not enough to be kind and beneficial, but not true. But it's also not enough to be true without being kind and beneficial. So that awareness of truth has actually expanded and grown and shifted for me. But it's still a very, very core aspect for me of the spiritual path.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. Unity in diversity means what? Well, unity in diversity is, you can think about it with the waves of the ocean. So if you took a photograph or a video of the ocean, you sat on the beach or you sat on a cliff over the ocean, and you had a wide angle and a zoom lens at the same time, so you really could get a very big, beautiful image of the ocean. What you'd get is pictures or video of lots of different waves, some tall, some short, some wide, some narrow, some that seemed to go on forever, some that crashed immediately, some that were blue, some that were half white as they crashed into shore. That's the diversity. But ultimately, they're all ocean. And that's the same thing with us, is the diversity is the different colors, the different shapes, the different ways. I mean, 7 billion people, every one of whom has a different fingerprint. I mean, imagine, we're looking at just lines on a tiny little area. And yet, and not just 7 billion now, but all those who have existed since they started collecting fingerprints, not two are the same. Not two faces are the same. Not two eyes are the same. Now they're doing identification based on the iris scanner of the eye. Amazing. Not two are the same. And yet, we're all waves of the same ocean. And so either we can focus on the diversity. You're black, you're white, you're Hindu, you're Muslim, you're Christian, you're Jewish, you're Buddhist, you're rich, you're poor, you're fat, you're thin, you're old, you're young, you're my people, you're their people. Or we can focus on the oneness. And it's a direct connection to the superficiality or the depth on which we live. On the most superficial layer, it's all about the diversity. And there's nothing wrong with that. Again, that's not inherently bad. The garden is beautiful because of so many different types of flowers. That's what makes a beautiful garden. A safari is so interesting because we see so many different types of animals. Humanity is so interesting because so many different types. It's beautiful. But the awareness of the underlying unity. So we're able to appreciate the beauty of diversity, but be connected to and grounded in the oneness and identified with the oneness.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Mike Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. Is telepathic communication possible or impossible? It's very possible. But just because science has named five, and science can measure five, and five of them have aspects that our scientific measurements can pick up. They're sound waves, light waves, actual molecules of things that we can, taste. We know where the receptors are. That's not our only way of knowing. We have more than five senses. It's just that science is able to measure five. So we can specifically say this is a molecule of sweetness versus this is a molecule of sourness. This is a low frequency wave versus a high frequency wave. This is a light wave that's going to activate my rods versus the one that's going to activate my cones. But just because science is able to understand those doesn't mean that those are all there are. So can we communicate through sound waves? Of course, we call it speaking. Can we communicate non-verbally? Of course, it's how we move our bodies, it's through touch. Can we communicate through our minds? Absolutely. In fact, there's now a wonderful machine that makes this not even a question of faith, but a question of science. You know, they do brain scans. They used to be able to only do brain scans hooking up the receptors, the wires to the brain itself. Now, they actually have the brain scanning machine, but that is a few inches away from the head, based on the magnetic response. And so our thoughts are actually sending out waves through our skull into the air that inches away from my skull A machine is actually able to pick up and read, just as though the sensors were placed on my head. So we now know that thoughts actually go out into the world, that thoughts are things, that they move through the world much as sound does, much as light does. So it's only a matter, though, of our ability to refine the technique. So when children are very, very young, they can't speak clearly, blah, 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 right? They're able to make noise, but they haven't yet learned how to properly vocalize so people can understand them. In the same way, most of us have not yet learned how to properly vocalize, you could say, our thoughts. Similarly, most of us have not yet perfected how to hear that, because there's two parts to telepathy. One is the outgoing, the other is the incoming. Can I send it out? Sure, but if nobody's able to pick it up, it doesn't do me much good. So we need to work on our communication and on our receiving of the communication. Much in the same way children need to learn how to speak, and in the same way they need to learn how to understand. When you first learn a language, you have no idea what it means. People could be speaking beautiful Greek to us here and we wouldn't know what it meant. I don't speak that language. Well, if we haven't learned to hear the language of thought waves, it's going to be difficult for us to pick it up. But it's absolutely possible.
This is OTR FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls Project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
When I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom, for taking you to your therapies, for understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati, and thanks for coming back and joining us for more of inspiration and transformation. Hinduism is not a religion that converts. It is not a proselytizing religion. And one of the main reasons for it is there's no concept within Hinduism that there's a way of worship that's wrong. The only way of worship that's wrong is not to worship. Not to connect. The only name of God that's wrong is to not talk to God. Otherwise, within Sanatan Dharma, this eternal Dharma, which is really what the name of Hinduism is, and we'll talk about Dharma in a minute, there's no right and there's no wrong. So it's not a religion that goes out and says, you need to worship God by this name or that name or this form or that form or this way or that way. If what we find is that people are being converted through incentives, well, rather than being just angry at that, the question we need to ask ourselves is, why do they need it? So why is it that they need to convert to another religion in order to get health care, in order to get education, in order to get all of the things that they are being promised and lured with. And it's so easy to say that's wrong. It's a lot harder to build schools and hospitals. And rather than yelling about what other religions are doing, rather than saying that's wrong, what's more important for us is to say, well, if they're needing to change their religion in order to give their children the possibility of an education, in order to get good medical care, in order to get a free operation at a hospital, well, then maybe it's our fault. Maybe we are not living up to our understanding of Sanatan Dharma. Because we have forgotten those people. You know, one of the crucial tenets of Sanatan Dharma is Vasudev Kutumbakam. The world is a family. And if we're not providing education, healthcare, other relief in such a way that people have no choice, changing religions is not something that comes easily to people. It's not like you wake up one day and the same way you decide, oh, let me try that new brand of toothpaste that I saw an advertisement for. You don't wake up one day and say, I know. Let me change my religion. It only happens if there's a sense of desperation that within my own tradition, something seriously is lacking. And in a tradition that is Sanatan, eternal, that isn't dogma, that isn't saying to you that mantra is wrong, the only thing that could make me so desperate is not going to be within my religion, it's going to be in my way of life. I don't have money to eat. I don't have a way to send my children to school. My mother's sick, I can't afford to give her medicine. And if there are people who are saying to me, come to our hospital, come to our school, and as part of the package deal of being at their school or being at their hospital, because theirs is a proselytizing religion, they want me to accept their name of God. It's going to take somebody pretty staunch to say, no, that's okay, let my mother die, I'm not going to accept your form of God. Especially if I've been raised in Sanatan Dharma, which says all names are God's. Every name is God. So even within my Sanatan Dharma, I could say, yeah, sure, okay, you want me to say your name of God? No problem, sure, of course. Because all names are His. You want me to worship this form of God? Okay, no problem. All forms are His. So if that's the core of my belief, and somebody is saying, if you chant this prayer, we will save your mother, or we will save your child, who's not going to do it? So when you ask me, you know, about your, if your help is being converted, what I would say to you is, find out what is so desperate in their lives that they're having to leave their own culture behind in order to have. And then the question becomes, how can we give it to them? Where have we forgotten our duties? And that's much harder, but ultimately it's much richer than just criticizing or condemning people of other religions for what they're doing. At least they're giving the medical care. At least they're giving the education. Okay, it's strings attached. But at least they're doing it. What actually does dharma mean? When we say eternal dharma, what is dharma really? And this is something that comes up so frequently. So many people say, how do I know what my dharma is? Well, dharma is actually that which protects us. That's the meaning of dharma. Dharma is that which protects us. Dharma is that which holds us together. You can think of Dharma as the glue that holds us together internally, my life, and also that holds my society together. You can think of Dharma as the umbrella under which we live, that protects us from the storms of life. Many times people mistake Dharma to think that it means my Dharma is to be the CEO of a company, or my Dharma is to be a billionaire, or my Dharma is to be a really, really famous Bollywood actress. And we've mistaken Dharma into this concept of what I think I should be. And the problem with that is that most of that which is our Dharma is not always very exciting. It's not always very fun. It's not always very pretty. There's a great story that Pooja Swamiji shares frequently about a saint and a scorpion. And the story is that this saint was bathing in the river, and there was a scorpion that was also in the river drowning. And the saint went to pick up the scorpion to save it, to put it on the side of the river, and the scorpion bit him. And as the scorpion bit the saint, he went, like you imagine a scorpion bites you. So he flings the scorpion, who falls back down into the water. The saint then scoops up the scorpion again to put him back on the side of the river. And again, the scorpion stings him. And again, the saint flings his hand, and again, the scorpion falls in the water. And this drama goes on several times, with the saint continuing to try to save the scorpion, and the scorpion continuing to sting the saint. And finally, somebody who's watching from out on the riverbank says, "Baba, that's a scorpion. He's going to keep stinging you. Why save him? Let him drown. He's never going to appreciate what you did. He's always going to sting you. Just let him drown." And the saint says to this person, he says, "The scorpion is stinging me because it is his dharma to sting. That's what a scorpion does. It is my dharma to save. And if the scorpion is not leaving his dharma, why I should leave my dharma?" And it's a story that Pooja Swamiji shares frequently when people take advantage of his saintliness. And people will say, "Oh, just let that one die," or, "forget this one." And so Pooja Swamiji shares the story very frequently because he says, "Yes, I understand there are scorpions in the world. There are snakes in the world. But if they're not leaving their dharma of biting and stinging, why should I leave my dharma of saving?" So fulfilling your dharma sometimes gets you stung. It was Arjun's dharma to fight the war. He didn't want to fight it. Having to fight that war, having to fight any war is not fun, but especially having to fight a war against your family, against your gurus. That was not pretty. That was not what Arjun thought would be a nice way to spend the day or the month or the year. This was how we got the whole Bhagavad Gita, was Arjun said, "Forget it. Even if I'm going to get glory out of this, even if I'm going to get a kingdom out of this, forget it, I don't want it." But Krishna said, "You must fight, even you're going to die." He didn't say to him, "Don't worry, You will be victorious. He said, even if you die, fulfilling your dharma, that is better than not fulfilling your dharma. And so it's important to remember that when we talk about what is my dharma, that it's not always fun. It's not always pretty. It's not always pain-free. Sometimes that which we are put here to do gets us stung. Sometimes we have to fight battles. But fulfilling that dharma is our highest calling. And it's not always very big. A lot of times people think, well, if it's my dharma, it must be something really, really big and important. But like the story with the snake, I mean the scorpion and the saint, his dharma was just to try to get that scorpion out of the river. It wasn't, I'm going to be the biggest guru in the world and, you know, everybody in the world is going to come to me and fall at my feet and put me on a pedestal. My dharma is just to try to get this scorpion out of the river. So our dharma is literally just doing that which we are here for. And it may change. It may change as our lives go on. At a certain point of our life, our dharma may be to be married and have children and get our children grown, take care of our children. The dharma of a householder to take care of the house, take care of the children. Prior to that, the dharma was different. After that, the dharma may be different. But it's not always very glory-filled. A lot of times people say, well, you know, how do I know what my dharma is? As though you're going to, you know, Pick a tarot card or get your fortune read and the person's going to say to you, your dharma is to be the biggest of this, the most important of that, the greatest of this. Your dharma may be feed your family. And in order to do that, you may have to be a mail clerk. That may be the only job you can get. But a lot of times what happens is in this illusion that somehow my dharma means it's supposed to be something that's never been done, something that's huge, something that's spectacular, we don't fulfill our real dharma. So if my dharma is putting food on the table for my family, but being a mail clerk, or pumping gas, or delivering newspapers, or doing whatever low-level job I could get doesn't feel to me like it's in line with my dharma. Well then, under this guise of waiting to fulfill my dharma, I'm actually failing to fulfill my dharma. It's not that the mail clerk itself is this thing that I was put here on earth for. It's that through being a mail clerk, I'm getting this salary, and with this salary, I'm feeding my family, and that's my dharma. And so it's really important for us to always understand that the dharma may not be that which is the most obvious. The dharma may not be the role, the title, the career. The dharma may be something through that. Just like Arjun's dharma wasn't to be a killer. That wasn't his dharma. Arjun's dharma was to be a bringer of dharma, to restore dharma, to be a king, a righteous king. But in order to be a righteous king, he had to do this job of killing. Otherwise, people would say, forget it, that's not my dharma to kill. I'm not a killer, I'm a king. Well, how exactly are you going to become a king if you don't fight that battle? And so when we talk about dharma, it's really important to understand that it's a much deeper concept than just what's the job I was put here to do, or what's the title I was put here to have, or what's the spectacular thing that my life was supposed to unfold. The spectacular thing our life is supposed to unfold is who we are. The rest of it is just our way of doing it. If we can help and serve and heal and be spreaders of love and peace, it's a bonus. It's what Arjun wished he could do, but he couldn't do it temporarily. Eventually he could, but he had to go through this war. If we don't have to actually kill people on our path in order to bring about dharma and righteousness, consider it a bonus. If you don't get stung by the scorpion along the way, consider it a bonus. The last piece on this I wanted to mention is that a lot of times people, when we talk about dharma, they think, well, I'm really trying, I'm doing it, but I'm not getting anywhere. I know this is my dharma, but it's not happening. And if it's my dharma, well, it shouldn't be so difficult. I mean, if I'm doing it in line with the divine will, it should be more easy. I should be more successful. This boat I'm rowing should be moving. There's a beautiful parable of a man who was rowing a boat and rowed and rowed and rowed with great sincerity. Closed his eyes and rowed and rowed, and the night came and he rowed through the dark till his arms were tired. Just kept rowing because he had to reach there. And in the morning when the sun rose and he opened his eyes, he realized he hadn't gone anywhere. The view of the shoreline was exactly where it had been when he started rowing the day before. And he was devastated. How could this be? And he started yelling out to God, I'm rowing, I'm not getting anywhere. And somebody on shore said, well, maybe if you untie the boat from the dock, you'll be more successful at rowing it. And I love that parable because that's what happens to so many of us so frequently in our lives, is we're doing what we think is our dharma. We're rowing. And we feel like, but I'm not getting anywhere. And so we start to think, well, the boat is wrong, the oars are wrong, the river is wrong, I'm in the wrong direction, my dharma's wrong. Without understanding, well, maybe I'm chained here to the shore. And each of us have different things that keep us chained, but it's always some combination of our ego or our grudges or our unfulfilled, unfulfillable expectations or our endless desires or whatever it is. But that's the stuff that keeps us from being able to move. And rather than looking at that rope that's holding us to shore, we give up on our dharma. Go to sleep in the boat, forget it. I mean, I'm not getting anywhere anyway. Might as well just watch TV, right? Check Facebook. what's the harm? I mean, I'm rowing, I'm not getting anywhere. Just watch a movie on my phone. Why not? Without looking and understanding, well, how can I figure out how to untie this thing from the shore so that when I row, I'll actually get there? So when we think about our dharma, it's important to also look at what is it that's holding us back and put just as much energy into untying ourselves from the shore as we do into trying to paddle that boat. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on OM Times Radio.